Homo sapiens. What an inventive, invincible species. It's only a few million years since they crawled up out of the mud and learned to walk. Puny, defenseless bipeds. They've survived flood, famine, and plague. They've survived cosmic wars and holocausts.
Now,
here they are, out among the stars, waiting to begin a new life, ready to outsit eternity. They're indomitable.
And coming up in this episode, it's the Tom Baker Special Part 1. And in the time-space visualizer, it's the Brain of Morbius led by...
Oh, me, yes.
And finally, we look at those two annuals, 1976 and the balmy world of 1977.
LSD.
It's the disco years! All this and more in Doctor Who.
The Complete Menagerie.
Almost.
Here we are. It's 1974.
The rock and roll years.
It feels like it, yes. Yeah, well, in your flat, it always feels like 1974.
It's 1974 forever for you, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. It's a nice place to be. Hello, I'm Sam.
Hello, I'm Greg.
Hello, and I'm Tom.
And we are The Complete Menagerie.
We are.
Almost.
A Doctor Who podcast dedicated to all things...
Doctor Who!
Yes.
That was almost as if we'd planned it there.
It was a science fiction series for children, but adults also adored it.
That's right, yes. It ended in 1989 and was never brought back.
That's right, yes. The final episode was Survival. Around about this time of year.
Yes, and also, we are recording the end of 2015, which I tasted both of you to say that it's now a longer period of time since Doctor Who has been off the air than it was since in 1989 when... hold on. can you explain
Devil's
what
Devil's End was made further ago.
No.
When Doctor Who originally ran, it ran for 26
That's
years.
That's right.
It's been off air
for 26 years.
For just over 26 years. It's been off air for longer than it was ever on air. Yes, the original run from Hartnell through to Sylvester McCoy, who was the final last Doctor Who.
Never to return to our screens.
No. How sad.
But we've got a whole treasure trove to mine.
Yes.
And enjoy.
Yes.
And we're going to be talking about possibly the greatest era of Doctor Who.
Ah, Trial of a Time Lord.
The early Tom Baker era. But before we do that, I'd like to seed my line.
Seed?
Line.
And my line is thus. What do you say, Professor? Shall we try it? Of course, it could be dangerous.
Now, Professor, that's what Ace used to call Doctor Who, didn't it?
It is. Ace did used to call Doctor Who.
Sophie Aldred played her. Is that a red herring?
No, it could be a red herring.
It's a red herring. I knew it was a red herring.
She's sexy, though, Sophie Aldred.
We've been over
that the other week. I can't be doing that again. Let's have this argument.
Okay.
Unfortunately, just to sideline for a moment, because the trailer has long been edited and you will... obviously, I've heard this many times, the trailer, if you're a fan of us.
Many times.
One of the lines which now sticks in my mind from that trailer is Greg saying, she's very popular with lesbians.
She's very popular with lesbians.
Mm. Well, that might be it, because she's not popular with me.
I almost want to make it my ringtone.
I love the idea of finding women attractive. Disgusting.
Couldn't agree more, Tom.
So the line is, what do you say... Professor, shall we try it? Of course, it could be dangerous.
Is Tom right? Has it anything to do with Sophie Aldred?
The only clue I'll give you is it's got nothing to do with Sophie Aldred.
Is it... I think Professor Lasky from Terror of the Vervoids.
Or there's Professor Jack Watling. What was his name? He was a
Professor.
Travers, that was it. Yes, he had the beard of... Rassilon.
You're moving in the right direction. Maybe we'll come back to it.
Okay. Well, it's just a minute.
Trying to think of more professors and
doctors. Exactly.
Professor Kettlewell.
Yes, is it Kettlewell?
Is it Kettlewell?
It could be Kettlewell.
Could be Kettlewell, is it? I think Kettlewell already is Kettlewell. Isn't Kettlewell?
As Edward Burnham. Oh, is it Edward Burnham's character in The Invasion?
No.
Is it Kettlewell?
It is Kettlewell. Hooray!
Hey! So that's from iRobot.
Yes, that's right, by Isaac Asimov.
Yeah, starring Derek Jacobi.
Yes.
So we got it.
Episode 1 of...
But who's saying it?
Oh, right.
It's just a line.
Professor Kettlewell.
No,
he's not saying it about himself.
But he says something in return. He says, of course, it could be dangerous.
No, it's all one line.
Oh. For
goodness sake. Well,
I think it's Sarah Jane Smith saying it. It has it the is. Ring of Sarah Jane Smith.
Oh, good for Sarah Jane.
Saying it.
I tell you what, you've got we're it. Getting, we're getting yeah. doing oh, well on these, yeah, aren't yeah. we?
Into the time lash, we go.
Oh, but it's all arranged.
The maiden and I have important things to discuss.
Yes, Doctor.
The best of times.
Tom,
worst yes. of times. What, yes, Sam. What? 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 Ask me a question and I'll answer it.
Yes.
Is the early Tom Baker era, produced by Hinchliffe, the best era of Doctor Who? Do we think so?
Well, you say it like it's obvious. I don't think it is obvious, but it struck me yesterday as I was leafing through the programme guide by Jean-Marc Lefessier.
Oh, yeah, that's our favourite Frenchman.
Yes, and I was thinking, yes,
he's lefty.
It pretty much is. If you look through the stories, I mean, I don't know if you've got Jean-Marc to hand, Sam, if you can just go and fetch that. That might be useful, but we'll fill in. It's all right.
I'll go upstairs. I'll be right back.
Right. That's Sam going up that's the stairs.
By John Martin, obviously. Yeah. No, but as he goes, my point, I suppose, is that it is pretty bloody good, isn't it?
Mm.
I'm no aficionado of Doctor Who. I've watched it once or twice.
Yes.
But it just as a reminder of just looking at those stories that he produced, they're brilliant.
Well, it was a television show. And
oh, yes.
Of course, you had the Android Invasion that a lot of people say is not very good.
No, but as
it's
a sort of
very
a,
good in terms of quality of Doctor Who.
We're talking, what was his first? What was his first? Was it?
Well, I suppose Ark in Space was officially his first, well, because Womert was Tom Baker's yes. first, as written by
Barry Letts produced Rose.
Yes, yes. Barry Letts produced it.
But also Barry Letts Baker. Also pretty much all... laid in the whole first season for Tom.
Did it went so, up, yeah. all the way up to the horror of Bang Rock wasn't him, which I was surprised by. I thought
it has a hangover of the last era, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Tom Williams first was,
that was it. Going up, his last one was... Talons of Wang Chai.
Oh.
I just think, I'm no expert, but I think that you can't deny it. It's amazing, and it's amazing for a show that is by that time. How old is it? 17.
It's 11 years old.
11 years old. Beg your pardon. It's quite old. It's like it's quite. It's been going a long time to start making it that good, and it's just wonderful.
There's not a bad one in it.
There isn't. Really. I think the. Why it's so good is it had a very good platform to start with. Mr. Pertwee came along and effectively saved the show as the new leading man. In colour, good production values. And I think Mr. Pertwee left thinking, well, I've done the best job.
Mm.
No one can possibly do a better job than
I.
Well, they had a new idea. They said to set it all on Earth, and that was enough, I think. And he was charismatic enough, and it was well produced enough to sort of to get away with it. As you say, it saved the show. But then with Tom Baker, it didn't really do anything much new. It wasn't like a new concept. Let's set it all on Earth, like we had with Pertwee. It was just good. Well, it was like the new thing was let's make it good.
Well, Wobert feels as if it could be a John Pertwee story,
yeah,
doesn't
yeah.
it?
It's a bit of a
but the Ark in Space, rock. I think, is a massive leap. We've never had Doctor Who like that before.
But do you
that's
think that's what
the plot of Alien?
Do you think that's what they did? It is, yeah. Do you think that's what they did? Just say let's just make it good.
Hmm, maybe.
Was that sort of a production meeting?
It's more
you know,
adult,
we've had
this
programme with for quite a while. Should we try and make it quite
it's
good?
It's been mediocre for the last 4 years.
But
we've been treading water. Yeah. It's solid. It's good. It's 3 out of 5. Let's make it 4 or 5 out of 5.
Incredibly formulaic, the last Mr. Pertwee.
Safe. They played it safe.
And I think repetitious as well.
Yes.
When you talk about... Tom Baker. This is how I think of Tom Baker. His later stuff, you watch it and you think he's kind of lost interest. The writers and the producer aren't quite on with it. Of course, you've got the Douglas Adams stuff, which it kind of works.
Yes.
But when I think of Tom Baker and I think of my favourite Doctor Who, I think of Tom Baker. I think of Tom Baker in this era. I don't think of it in even City of Death's great and stuff like that. But these are the ones that really hook you in and make you a Doctor Who fan. I think
maybe up to. I mean, Horns of Nymon, when he's got Graham Crowden to work with.
It's lost something by then, I think.
Yeah,
it's still good, it's still entertaining, but I think this is the era where you go, these are fucking brilliant.
Yeah, and you can watch them again and again and again.
There's a few reasons, though. I think, apart from having a very good platform to start with, Barry Letts and Terence Dix.
A Buddhist.
A very, very good, very good office of talent and writers that they had access to.
Yeah,
at this point...
A Buddhist?
At this point, I think the show had proportionally the most spent on it per episode that it ever had. Judging by something that JNT said in the 80s, that each episode of Doctor Who, I know people are going to write in and correct us on this, had about £25,000 per episode. That had not been adjusted since the mid-70s.
That's so a hell of a chunk of moolah.
In 1975, 1974, if they were spending £25,000 on an episode before the inflation crisis of the later 70s, it shows on screen. Money. It looks very expensive.
You could buy a house for tuppence halfpenny in those days.
Exactly.
And you saw people in the streets just going around with wheelbarrows full of dollars, didn't you?
Yep.
Well, that's why my Germany. Sorry. No, but it was a lot of money. I mean, yeah, 25K.
Well, what was the economy like at the time? Because then it crashed, didn't it?
Much better than it was in the later 70s.
Yes, it was pretty grim.
In the later 70s, budget effectively halved.
Well, we're going to come on to this in the next episode of Doctor Who, The Complete Menagerie, almost. We've actually got a special guest talking about politics in the 70s.
Oh, we're getting political.
Yes, we are, and that's when
it's
we
not
can
supposed
bring
to be political.
We can bring it all up
Nathan
then.
Turner.
So you are suggesting that they had a bit of money to spend. So
they did,
quite,
with a daring
useful.
Young producer that
wasn't
afraid.
I mean, he's still going now, isn't he? I mean, I suppose they were young when they started Doctor Who.
As I'm speaking now, there's only Derek Sherwin and Philip Hinchcliffe, who are the two living producers of the original Doctor Who.
But he's about 50 now, isn't he? He's quite strapping young man.
His daughter's a correspondent for the BBC.
No.
He's quite a handsome chap as well, I have to say, Philip.
He's got that sort of widow's peak going on.
Yeah,
isn't he? That's good. That's okay.
A sort of a long but appealing and lined face.
Aquiline.
He could well have been an actor, couldn't he?
So you have a young producer, but let's think about this. Was Tom Baker the youngest actor to play Doctor Who at this point?
He was young. He was alive. Actually, he was sexy.
He was in his 40s. Wasn't he
40?
43? It was 42 or 3 when Brandon Morbius...
Well, hang on, when was he born? 34?
He's 81 now.
So he'd been 41?
Yeah, so 40. Let's say 40. Cut the mustard at 40.
Okay.
Split the difference.
He'd just turned 40, I believe.
Yes. I mean, we're approaching 40. Imagine we were just about to take on the role of TV's Doctor. It makes you feel exhausted, doesn't it? Yes. Just even thinking about it.
As Tom Baker said in his autobiography, "Who on earth is Tom Baker?"
Yes.
I went from who to who.
No, but imagine the work that he put in. And if you had to do that now, God bloody hell, I don't think I could be bothered, really, you know.
I'd say, get me back on that building site.
That's a great story, that, isn't it? Yes. So he was a young leading man.
A young thruster.
A young thruster.
Young
producer.
A decade younger than his leading man.
Mr. Pertwee.
And they obviously, you know, this has long been a thing. They've taken tropes from films and TV genres and just said, right, we'll do that. So, you know, Brandon Morbius, which we'll get to later, is basically Frankenstein, but better, because Frankenstein's a bit wearying around the middle.
Yes.
And there's other stuff that they decide to do, you know, just hard. To sort of, let's do the... Yeah, other examples of, as you say, an alien movie in the Ark in space.
So. In outer space.
But they also had the most freedom, I think, at the time, because Philip Hinchcliffe pushed the limit of what he could put on the screen, I think, in terms of violence.
Yes.
And they never recovered from it. So he had the honeymoon period, and then poor old Graham Williams, who was to follow, had no money and had to make it funny instead of scary.
Yeah.
So comparatively,
but did he have
there's
to?
Two
well,
half
very cheap
to.
Sets in the Williams era. The sets are beautiful in the Hinchcliffe era.
Yeah.
I mean, in the Williams era, they're all sort of undecorated flats, aren't they? They're beige colours.
And quickly lit.
And,
very quickly lit.
We more recently watched the final episode of The Armageddon Factor, which is getting off Hinchcliffe, but it's by way of contrast that this is the season finale. This is what the Key to Time season has been building up to. And most of episode 6 is either appalling CSO or it's shot in this empty beige room with a little console with a glittering light in the middle. But that would have been inconceivable.
Well, compare
somehow
it to
in the Hinchcliffe
era. Talons of Wang Chiang, which there's a documentary feature on that you can see the behind the scenes of deep Roy playing ping pong.
Yes, I was on a plane with him.
But were you playing ping pong?
Yes, he won.
It was he thought it was tennis. Unfair ping pong. And obviously with the giant rat, but that was slightly mediocre in terms of production values, but it was noticeable how really, that could have been a sort of a BBC costume drama.
Yes.
Sunday afternoon, sort of yes. Brideshead. It's a bit slightly before Brideshead Revisited, but it was actually a tea yes. time children's show.
Yes.
But it's little bloody good. So yes, it did look good.
And they
good.
Did the Victorian era very well.
But I think that Tom Baker was at his prime then, because and just watching Brain and Morbius, which we'll get to later, it reminds you of what a brilliant Doctor he is. And it's not a funny story. It's not like they were going for laughs then, but he's so charming and hilarious. The script for him in all those stories, which Seeds of Doom, Zygons, although he's wonderful, wonderfully written, and he has a sort of joy about playing it that I think he loses quite later on because he gets a bit complacent.
Well, even the bits he downplays, I mean, it's rather a more highbrow joke, but I love it in Talons when he says to Leela, "I brought you to the wrong era, my dear girl. You'd have loved Agincourt."
Yes,
and that's a lovely line.
But of course, you've got Sarah Jane as well. So we talked recently, didn't we, about which Doctor and companions go well together. And I think it is Tom Baker and Sarah Jane
Is
Smith.
That who you think of when you think of Tom Baker?
Yeah, all the time, Sarah because of this era, I think. And obviously he had Leela as well, but I don't think
but
that...
But two strong companions. Two strong companions also help to make a good Doctor, don't they?
Yes, and I think Sarah Jane and Pertwee worked okay, but I think when you know, just the partnership, they were more equals. You know, obviously Pertwee's a patrician... You've got the urban and the bohemian sort of curly mop of hair, teeth.
Yes, Parisian.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you can better it. Sam, do you agree with all this? Are you sitting rather?
It's an interesting thing because I am nostalgic about this era of. I'm holding up the Jean-Marc Loffessier.
Jean-Marc Loffessier.
Purely because not only was it brilliant, but it was some of the first titles to be released on video home cassette.
Videos.
Were the early Tom Bakers. First VHS was Revenge of the Cybermen.
Revenge of the Cybermen. It was
£75.99. Now, there are some people who say that Revenge of the Clippermen is not very good.
But it's probably the worst one of the season. But
it's not great, but it's a
good
story.
It's pretty good.
You enjoy it.
They filmed it in Wookiee Hole.
Oh.
And Ian Martyr was there.
Continue your
great anecdote.
Continue. you should go on Woden. So,
the 12th season, so we have Robot the Ark in space, Sontaran Experiment.
Ah. Wonderful.
There's an anecdote about Sontaran Experiment.
He broke his collarbone.
There is. Genesis of the Daleks. Genesis of the Daleks Now.
Genesis of the Daleks.
We have discussed this, haven't we, in this podcast, but it's just wonderful. It was repeated.
The reason it's good is because Philip Hinchcliffe, plucky young 30-year-old newcomer producer Philip Hinchcliffe, stood up to Terry Nation. He said to Terry Nation, "You've given us this script two or three times before. It's good, it's good.
But it's not right.
It's not right."
And now, here's the man with all the catchphrases, Roy Walker!
What's Davros doing
now? Sorry for anticipating that.
It's good, it's not right. Television's Roy Walker.
You see there, Mr. Chips, what's he doing? Well, he's blowing up the Carling City.
14 pines in the bonus bag.
It's exploding a rocket.
It's the ready money rain.
He's a muto.
Anyway.
See Mr. Chips there with his gas mask on. See the doctor stepping over Mr. Chips. Sorry.
There's another figure we're missing out here, though.
Oh, Davros.
Dave,
a backroom boy.
Jeff Hoon.
John Nathan Turner.
Bob Holmes.
Bob Holmes.
Bob Holmes,
He used to, as Tom Baker used to say, "I used to suggest ideas and he used to puff his pipe and provide a smokescreen to all of them."
And Bob Holmes gently turned me down.
Bob Holmes.
Tell us about Bob Holmes.
Bob Holmes. Well, didn't he come to write Armchair Theatre and bits and pieces after doing Doctor Who? He was recognised as being a very good writer.
He was better than Pinter.
And then you can actually see his stories improving as he submitted them to Doctor Who. The Crotons is one of his. Not a great story.
Yeah,
better than Pirandello.
And The Space Pirates, I believe, was one of his.
The Crotons.
Yes.
Not great. But during the Pertwee era, he came in his own, didn't he? Just
came
great
into
stories.
His own.
Yeah. And became script editor. After Terry Dix.
Yes, dear Terry.
The early Tom Baker era, and created the new Doctor.
And the Sontarans.
Did he?
Yes, he created the Sontarans.
When you say he created the new Doctor, did he cast the Doctor?
No, that was Barry Letts.
Or did he just write Robot?
Terry Dick wrote Robot.
So what was Robert Holmes's...
He wrote Ark in Space.
He wrote Ark in Space.
That's pretty good.
Which is where the Doctor really arrives.
Ridley Scott reworked it as Alien a couple of years
ago. Yeah, he must have seen it, old Ridley.
But, Robert Holmes, I anecdotally said there, was better than Pinto, but he was a very fine writer, but it's generally only Doctor Who fans who know of him now. If you ask a Doctor Who fan, they'll know Bob Holmes and probably say Bob Holmes was the best writer who wrote for Doctor Who.
Before Russell T Davies came along.
Oh, and piffle, sold piffle, everything. Piffle, piffle.
No! Because this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to rescue him. I'm going to save Rose Tyler from the middle of the Dalek fleet, and then I'm going to save the Earth, and then, just to finish off, I'm going to wipe every last stinking Dalek out of the sky!
But you have no weapons, no defenses, no plan!
Yeah. And doesn't that scare you to death? Rose?
Yes, Doctor?
I'm coming to get you.
Soiled everything with his Welsh shit.
Yeah, turned it into a soap opera.
But no, Bob Holmes was better than Pinter. He actually gave Pinter the idea for the pause that was written into the Ark in Space. It kept having these pause things, and then the director had to say, we haven't got time for all these pauses, and so he sent the pauses to Pinter, and the rest is history.
And then J&T reworked it into a hiatus.
Hey! Very good. Very good. Very
good. Thank you. Thank you. I'm here
That's
all day.
That's our best joke.
If you want a joke provided, just write to Samuel Payne, 44 Paradise Tower.
So, season 13.
Yes.
We're going to season 13 with Terror of the Zygons. Oh,
yes, they're all in that.
Orgasmatron. Yeah. Wonderful.
Followed by Planet of Evil, Puritan of Mars, The Android Invasion, Brain of Morbius, and Seeds of Doom.
Seeds of Doom. Tony Beckley.
Breaking it down, is the 13th season the best season of the Hinchcliffe era?
Let's have a look. Wow. Let's have a look.
I mean, it's some fantastic
definitive. It's definitive, I think.
But then you've got, then at 14th, you've got Hand of Fear, Talons of Wang Chiang, Robots of Death, and The Deadly Assassin. Four are wonderful serials. I think, you know...
Hang on, Terror of the Zygons and The Seeds of Doom in the same season?
But I believe Terror of the Zygons was produced in the first production block of the previous season, or the second production.
Both written by Robert Banks Stewart. I think they're only ones he wrote.
A Scot.
Yes. He's still alive.
Is he?
Yeah.
Crumbs.
I believe so. No, he's alive.
If you go from Ark in Space, we've got 1, 2, 4, 10, 12, several stories. There's about 15. There isn't such a good run in the whole history of Doctor Who.
There's not a bad one in it.
It's the consistency is excellent all the way through.
I mean, I loved old Pertwee's first season, but to say that Pertwee had that number of decent stories all in a row, I think
Ambassadors is a bit dry.
Exactly. No, it's a 7 episode as well.
I would, it's a 3 out of 5.
Because they cut it all down. They said, right, let's have 6 or 4, 4 or 6, and usually 4. And as we all know, episode 3 of a Doctor Who story can be a little bit tiresome.
With any story.
But I don't think if you watch those, there's not much fat, is there?
Well, it's at this point they introduce the 2 and the 4-parter. So you get a 2-parter with a 4-parter, a 4-parter, and then a 2-parter connected.
Well, that was only done very rarely.
No, it was done in The Seeds of Doom and Talons of Wing Chang, if you think of story structure.
Yeah, so I see what you mean. I beg your pardon. Not officially, but I beg your pardon.
And I think that was a piece of genius. They didn't like doing six-parters.
It was done before or since.
But Seed of Doom...
Such a high quality.
Yes, it's 2 episodes of one thing and then 4 of another.
It's half a dozen of one.
It is. six of the other, yes.
Is there anyone in this known universe who wouldn't watch that stuff and go, "Four blimey, Governor, give us a copper kettle"?
Well, now, I don't know if I should say this live on air, but you text me to say that your wife had voluntarily put on Genesis of the Daleks.
Yes,
watched it of her own accord.
No, it was on the Horror Channel, which is a great boon to us. But I just walked in to find that amongst all the channels that are available to anyone in the known universe, she'd selected Genesis of the Daleks and just was sitting down with her knitting and just enjoying it and saying, "Oh, this is quite good, isn't it?"
Because
she speaks like that. Yeah. But that's wonderful, isn't it? She's a complete non-who person. She's relatively normal.
But here was Terry Nation who'd had his script turned down, and rather than say, well, fuck you, BBC, I'm Terry fucking Nation, he didn't say that at all. He went away and thought, now, hang on a minute, and came up with the idea. Well, I think it was Philip Hinchcliffe, wasn't it, who said, why not tell us about how the Daleks came into being in the first place? And that's what... That was the genesis of history, the idea.
The genesis of the genesis of the Daleks.
And it still stands up very well today.
It's very good, but I think it more has the ring of Bob Holmes's writing.
Ah.
And I think it was heavily edited.
You reckon?
I'm guessing.
Well, anyway...
Because there's a book available called Doctor Who Scripts 1974. They only ever did one of these. They should have done them for every season. And you can see the amendments that were made from the submitted script to Bob Holmes's version and also the transmitted version. It's very interesting to see the flair which Bob Holmes put onto all
he
of the stories.
He had a lot of flair.
He liked words.
Flair was very popular in the 70s.
It was very good indeed.
So my question still stands, though, that is there anyone who is remotely interested in Doctor Who that would watch this era and think, no, there's a better era, the Trial of a Time Lord, that sort of thing?
Well, there are some foolish people, but everything is good about it. It's not just that the story... I mean, the most important thing is that the stories are great.
Yeah.
But everything is great. The sets are great. He's got a lot of money spent on it, as Sam said.
Tom's great.
Comes onto screen. Doctor Who's costume is never better than in this
wonderful.
Era. Is
it wonderful?
Is it better?
No.
June Hudson, eh? Yeah. She's a cracker. Yeah.
Well, we know who actually designed the costume for him. It was the same guy who looked after Mr. Pertwee's jackets.
Ah. Lembit Opik.
Was it... Toulouse-Lautrec?
The man behind the costume for Tom Baker was James Acheson.
Oh.
Who later went on to work in movies.
James Acheson, yes,
and
that's
right. He was
right,
influenced by Toulouse-Lautrec, as you
say. He looks very like that chap, the Irish chap out of the
X-Factor. He's a genius, because he was also responsible for the Centaurians and the Zygones.
Oh, the Zygones. Yeah. They're very good, yes.
And the robot. And the actual robot.
Zygotes. Oh, the Wobot.
Yes. So he was responsible for that. And also another designer that we were also just mentioning.
Is that the original design for the Doctor Who costume there?
Yes, we're looking at a picture here, and it's a gouache, I'd say. Would you say it was a gouache, Tom?
No idea what you're talking about.
I got a beef goulash. Yes, tell us more.
Goulash. It's a sketch of Tom Baker with a long red coat.
With his crotch thrust forward.
And a waistcoat and a very long scarf. And strange hair, actually.
Looking very heroic, though, but very...
Legs akimbo, very buccaneer.
Yeah, buccaneer, that's the word, yes.
Buccaneer.
Absolutely, spot on.
But James Acheson, responsible for the costume, and a very student-y feel, a very loose feel. Nowhere near the patrician feel that you have.
No tight-fitting costumes.
I want you to zoom in on that face. How do you do that?
You can you?
Can't be done on this. Oh yes,
there we are.
The
laughing face of Tom Baker. He's like the laughing cavalier.
He is rather, yes. His crotch follows you around the room.
It's rather Dutch master, isn't it?
Yeah.
Roger Murray Leach, a very skilled production designer, works on a few of the stories. Brilliant. Responsible as well for making a lot of the money get on the screen.
It makes so much difference, doesn't it, when you look at Revenge of the Cybermen, The Ark in Space, of course the same set. But it's got this sense of space and it's got this sense of scale.
Mm.
Whereas if you look at something from the Graham Williams era where it's all shot against flats. It's very dry on the eye, isn't it? There's no sense of depth or scale or anything, whereas even just shot on tape, when you look at those early Tom Bakers, they have more of a cinematic feel to them. Am I right?
They do. I believe so. And I think we're right in saying this is the era where they started to do videotape location work, which marries together so much better in an episode, I think.
Sontaran experiment is shit, though, isn't it?
I
like it.
Come, chat. Kumquat.
That's a lovely little story.
I enjoy it. Kumquat.
No, I was being deliberately controversial.
Yeah, no, I think it's quite nice.
It looks beautiful.
Yeah.
It's on Dartmoor Rocks.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think it's a good little piece.
It's just two episodes. It's
doesn't outstay its welcome, does it?
No, it's not harmful. And he's got Ian Marter in it.
He was a wonderful companion and was cast ahead of Tom Baker being cast.
I think you know, I'm not a big fan of the leader as a character. I like her in her skimpy costume, but I do think Ian is wonderful. It's like getting back to the old Ian and Barbara days of having a sort of a a more sort of handsome, lantern-jawed, a bit like Samuel Payne himself, although it's more like a doughy lantern these days. We were remarking on
Tom's earlier. Done some lovely sketches.
Such a silver tongue charmer.
I must say, I was sketching the old Paleo, and there was a temptation to give him a doughy look, and I had to revise. I've got a whole bunch of sketches at home. Paleo fat. a few pounds on him, but.
I look like a shaved John Nathan Turner.
You do.
Actually, Tom, you look like you've lost some weight.
No.
I said that at your wedding, and he denied it.
People always say that. It's just because I always, in people's minds, I'm fat. When they see me in real life, they just go, well, have you lost weight? I think I'd take the compliment, but I think it's just that you think of me as a bigger fat fucker. It's marvellous.
We're powering into the 14th season.
We are. And I think,
opening with The Mask of Mandragora.
Yes, wonderful stuff. Yes. Filmed in Port Merion.
Port Merion.
Mm.
They're all in it. Beautiful. Mandragora. That's a narcotic drug.
It is, yes. Yeah.
You know, they actually...
We've all taken drugs, Sam. Don't look askance. We've all had drugs.
They've called it the Mask of Opium. Yeah. What are the kids taking?
Sarah Jane's last story.
Yeah,
I love it. I just love it. The last episode is a bit weak, but it's one of my favourites. I just really like it.
You
it's
like the location, Bob don't Martin, you?
The location is great. Eldred must live. All that.
Eldred must live.
Yes, it's just.
Episode 4 is a bit of a mess.
It is, but then we'll forgive her than that.
And then the deadly assassin. It's a Doctor owned story. There's not many assassins that aren't deadly, unless you're Roger Moore. But this is when Tom Baker wanted to go it alone or have a talking cabbage.
Yes,
I believe.
It was okay. I mean, that was a good idea for one. Well, the other thing that's the point that he wasn't resting on his laurels, was he, old Hinchcliffe? Because he's done all this stuff. The temptation with Doctor Who is to say that worked, let's do it again. But he doesn't do that, and I think with that, the 14th season, there's a lot of strange stuff in there. You know, the Deadly Assassin and the Hand of Fear are quite odd, I think. And they're not. Mm. The Hand of Fear is you know, it's not a film pastiche like some of them, but it's still damn good, I think. And the Deadly Assassin is very strange, isn't it?
Mm. When was it decided that it was a classic? Because when Deadly Assassin first aired, it came bottom of the poll for that season.
People didn't like the Time Lords and how they were, represented on screen as courtly people complaining about their hips and life.
That was another thing he brought to it, was the Time Lords with a sort of a character that you kind of got this idea of who the Time Lords were. Which
they're more like the Roman Empire, aren't they? Yeah. These crotchety old senators.
They were sort of forever interfering and doing those sort of... They were always in the background of, well, not every story, but a lot of the stories, and then when you actually get to see Gallifrey on The Deadly Assassin, that is sort of a bit of a, lovely.
Yes, they are. They're humanized, and people didn't like that. It's a lighter touch as well. There's a lot of humour from Bob Holmes. It's a Bob Holmes script, isn't it?
And it has the late Hugh Walters, Deadly Assassin, died this year.
I like the Deadly Assassin very much.
Face of Evil, Robots of Death, wonderful.
Face of Evil is one of my favourites.
Face of Evil is also one of the funniest Doctor Who's, without being silly.
It's a send-off of religion.
Yes, it is.
Essentially. So Anon. And,
do you guys mind if I just have a chocolate? Might mean
it cloys the palate.
Well, I won't say anything for a while.
You have a good chomp down there.
The Face of Evil, really, we'll probably go into another time. We do have a religion special on the horizon, and it's probably the best one to talk about.
Okay.
So we won't go into too much detail.
I don't think we talk enough about religion on this
The Robots of Death, considered to be a very straightforward story.
It's an Agatha Christie in space.
Mm. But they made it very beautiful. Art Deco.
Oh, it's lovely design. There's no doubt about it.
And Louise James
is delicious. Okay. We haven't got any nuts in this episode. We just
a nut-free episode.
Yeah, just for the allergens among you. Sorry, Kathy.
So you're safe.
I'm saying I really, really like The Robots of Death. I think it's just a wonderful Doctor Who story. I love the music. And the whole era, actually, I think. Correct me here. Was scored by Dudley Simpson.
Consistently all the way through. It's how I think of, because I was watching Brain and Morbius, it's how I think of Doctor Who music should be.
Mm. Yes.
What kind of instruments was he using? You know about this sort of thing.
He used the bassoon.
Yeah.
Yes.
That sort of thing.
I think it had a very small quartet.
But it kind of...
Percussion.
They're all midgets.
It seems right, doesn't it? Deep Roy. conducting.
Deep Roy on drums.
He had a small number of instruments, and I think what they did is they added a few synthesizers on top.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it wasn't enough time to do a full synthesized score in those days.
Another episode, we'll listen to some of that music. Yeah.
We will. We'll go over that. Maybe in the second part.
But that means
Tom Baker special.
The Tom Bola special.
Yes, but they followed
the Ebola special. One of us will have Ebola by the end of it.
They followed it with Talons of Wang Chiang. It's like, how can it get any better? And then there's Talons of Wang Chiang.
Triumphant.
Lots of great in-jokes as well. Of course, the giant rat is a reference to Sherlock Holmes' story. There's lots of Sherlockian references, of course. Where Watson famously says in one of the Sherlock Holmes stories, and then of course Holmes does our adventure with the giant rat of Sumatra, to which Holmes replies, no, Watson, that is a story for which the world is not yet prepared.
And that's the Talons of Wang Chiang.
and then it comes up in Talons of Wang Chiang, of course. Yeah,
marvellous. Well, yes, I think we need to revisit the question. What was the question?
Question mark jumpers.
Is it the best of times?
Yeah.
Is it the worst of times?
No, it's the best of times, I think. It's fab, isn't it? And it's just, it gives you shivers just to think about it, I think.
A tale of two cities. Tale of one city. Yes. It is the best of times.
I was so pleased, I think it was about 5 years ago, when the Radio Times had the Christmas cover, and it was a Doctor Who-themed Christmas cover of a little snow globe.
Yes.
And the Doctor was pictured as a scarf-wearing bohemian with a hat. That is Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean...
And that was in the middle of the Russell T Davies nonsense.
That's brilliant. But I have to say, even before the series came back and it had been off air for a while, or at least some version of the series came back, I don't think it's bona fide Doctor Who. But if you ask the average man in the street to describe Doctor Who,
it's a scarf.
You would say a floppy hat and a scarf, wouldn't you? And probably Tom Baker.
And that comes from this era, so...
Iconic.
Well, I guess just a very short question. What were viewing figures doing at that point? Did they go through the roof? Were people really into it? They've got a chart.
At the end of the Pertwee era, we were looking at about 9 million viewers for Planet of the Spiders.
How many for Monster of Peladon?
Monster of Peladon, 7.7.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, well, shit.
So, you know, reasonably good. By the time Mr. Baker takes over the role, we're looking at 10, 11, 10, 9, and 9 million viewers
and
for
by the end
season.
Of the 14th, look, it's at 12.7 for Robots of Death. Now, obviously, these figures aren't indicative of anything other than how many people are watching the show, but it might be that ITV weren't broadcasting. We have that sort of issue with City of Death. But as it does look as if that more people are watching it. And I don't know, maybe this is... I don't think this applies these days because people watch any old shit these days.
Absolutely will.
But I think in the old days, if it was quality, it got more people watching it. And, you know, that's...
Edge of Darkness, after it finished its original run on BBC Two, because the BBC didn't have the guts to show anything, it didn't there'd be much interest, this highbrow eco-thriller. And then, due to public demand, they immediately repeated it on BBC One.
Yeah.
In 1985, so it was aired twice in 1985.
No! Since Tony Blair came in, the whole of the society's gone downhill, but as we know. But yeah, I mean, looking at this graph, you've got a couple of stories that really got massive.
There,
but that was
the power shortage.
That's the power shortage
of
some sort.
ITV,
but the moment
when ITV
Wang Chiang was over in the next season, it just went down to more sort of Pertwean levels. Interesting. Now I don't hold much truck by it hugely, but it's just interesting to see that the most popular era amongst we three. It's also the most popular amongst the general public. I mean, they don't fuck all, idiots. But
there's only four watching the latest Capaldi story.
Well, let's not get into that. But
that's
four people.
Not
yeah. Anywho, that's just a little aside. So, yes, I think it's the best era. Are you in agreement with that?
It can't be beaten. I mean, I enjoy visiting other eras, but this is the era that has all the classic stories, I think. Well, not all the classic stories.
But lots of
this. And to go in for a closer analysis, we're going to pick apart the typical Tom Baker four-part story, which Tom pushed forward, which is the brain of Morbius in the time-space visualizer.
Ha ha! I like that one.
It's a time-space visualizer.
And here we are in time-space visualizer talking about
at the brain of Morbius. Is it the brain of Morbius, or is it the brain of Morbius?
Most Doctor Who stories start with the.
Yeah, a good, honest the. Yeah,
until the 1980s when it was...
A definitive article.
Earth shock.
One word.
The Earth shock would have been
Castro
better.
Alba.
The Castro Alba would have been far better. Anyway, brain of Morbius.
Yes. What's it all about, Tom?
Well, indeed, what is it all about? Doctor Who arrives on a planet. Yes. He knows not where.
Khan.
That's it, Khan.
Khan.
You don't find that out until slightly later in the story. And essentially, there's two locations in this. Well, three, if you want to be clever about it. There's Solon, or Solon's lair.
Yes.
Castle. Frankenstein's castle, basically.
Yes.
And he's conducting some horrible experiments on bodies and whatnot.
He's like Dr. Mengele.
He is, and not more like Dr. Frankenstein. Mengele was a nasty piece of work. Frankenstein, I feel, was misunderstood. But so you have him, and you have his Igor or Igor type assistant called Colon. No, Colon Baker. Condominium.
Condo.
Condor Man, as I kept calling him last night. And he's old Philip Madoc in his lovely green outfit. We all like
Solon.
That. So long. Thanks for all the fish. So basically, you've got this guy who's Salman Rushdie. He's conducting all these experiments.
Yes.
I kept thinking of him. He looks a little bit like Salman, doesn't he? Salman Rushdie.
A sort of a Welsh Salman Rushdie.
So you've got a Welsh.
Oh, well, gun doctor.
Oh, gun doctor. Yeah, the fatwa. So you've got this Welsh Frankenstein,
yes.
who's also Salman Rushdie, who's interested in body horror as his henchman.
Yeah.
And he's in a castle, basically, and he's trying to create a creature. We'll get to that in a second.
From the depths of hell.
Indeed. And then you've got on the other side of the studio is the Sisterhood of Khan, who are basically a bunch of raddled old lesbians. With one particular one. You reminded me of Gloria Steinem. Gloria Steinem is a feminist. I don't think she's a lesbian, but she's a feminist, so halfway there. that's one for all you misogynists out there.
Are you talking about Cynthia Grenville?
That's it, yes. Cynthia Grenville. Yeah, and
do you know what this is time for?
What's that?
It's time for Section 28.
They have an inalienable right to be gay.
They have an inalienable right to be gay.
Isn't it terrible to think that
Patrick
Troughton is dead?
Yes.
John Pertwee is dead. And yet Margaret Bloody Thatcher, the baggage, still lives. Oh, no, wait, she's dead.
She's dead.
But no, Cynthia Grenville was a leser.
Really?
Is a leser. I think she's still alive.
She's still going. My God. She's
lesbian.
Lesbian.
Likes to munch down on a bit of Tom, you were telling us about the brain of Morbius.
Yes, so she's got her, and she's in charge of the Sisterhood, and so she looks like an extra from Planet of the Apes. She's wandering around with a chocolate cake on her head for the first two episodes.
Yes.
The big reveal is in episode three, the chocolate cake hat disappears. She sort of looks like Jane Goodall or Gloria Steinem now.
Yes.
Very sort of old and raggedy, and like Planet of the Apes, monkey hopping about the place. And you've got, she's kind of... they're the Sisterhood of Khan. They're very obsessed with this sacred flame, sacred fire.
Sacred flame, sacred fire!
And they've got this elixir of life, which they've kept them going for all these years.
That's good.
And so that's their thing. But it's reducing. It's reducing.
Cynthia Grenville now looks exactly like she did with the aged makeup.
She has a lot of slap on.
She does, yes.
An awful lot.
She was only about our age at the time.
Really?
Yeah.
God, she looks ancient.
Yeah.
Crumbs. Yeah. And then her little helper, who's a wide-eyed idiot, wasn't in much.
We've met her, Greg.
Really? We have, yes.
She kept
very nice.
This is a very visual thing, but if you can just widen your eyes, Greg, like this. She keeps doing that. You watch Brain of Morbius. You notice that he keeps widening your eyes, it's hilarious.
Or an eye flare.
An eye flare, yeah. So anyway, they think the Doctor is after their elixir. Solon in his castle is after the Doctor because he thinks he has the perfect head. No, he doesn't give perfect head. He wants his head to create this, put the head on top of this monster so he can, the body can inhabit the brain, in inverted commas, of Morbius. Now, who's Morbius? Morbius, as you will find out, is a Time Lord. He's done all sorts of nasty things. And the whole crux of the episode is that Solon wants to bring him back to life, essentially.
Bring him back, that's what I say.
So this is what the episode, the story's about. And this is all very, very neatly set up in the first half,
that's
really.
That's a sort of a literal version of the story.
I mean, no, I know.
The subtext is all about sexuality, isn't it? And
come
they
on,
are a coven of lesbians, and Doctor Who wants their elixir, and they don't want to give it to
him. He wants to lick them. Mm. I don't know. I haven't really thought about that. But, so this is essentially the sort of setup is that you've got this Morbius fellow who's a brain in the jar, and Solon is this evil scientist who's Frankenstein. I mean, I do like just the sort of the look of it.
A brain in a jar.
It's very baroque.
It is
baroque,
it reminds me of a film by Dario Argento called Deep Red. Which
when was that
very 1975.
Around the same year.
Deep Bread or Deep Red?
Deep Red, Profondo
Deep Roy.
Rosso.
Deep Roy.
It was made by the Italians.
Oh, yes.
And the design influences, so it's all oil lamps, painted doors, arcs.
Gallo. Gallo means yellow.
Art Nouveau.
Jallo.
Very much like Gaudi.
Everything
it's a Gaudi
slants.
Structure. It looks everything slants,
yeah,
weird shapes and arcs and circles.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
And I think it's very much of the time. It was making a big comeback in the mid-70s.
There was an element in film noir, wasn't there, with slanting angles and an element of it.
The Dutch tilt. Yes.
Which means something's off when you see it. You know they're saying not quite right. It's not just Gothic. There's a bit more to it than that, the other influences.
The design is beautiful, but then just in a cheap piece of studio.
Barry Newbury.
Shooting on tape.
Barry Newbury makes a comeback as a designer because he was in the first season of Doctor Who.
Died this year.
Working with Raymond P. Cusick. So he did all the...
Let's just have a minute's silence for Barry Newbury.
We've cut that.
He's dead. So it looks wonderful, and it's written with a sort of a verve, you know. And I noticed actually that it's a classic. And the last time we reviewed a classic, it was Curse of Fenric, a stone cold classic. I think I referred to it. And we watched it again, and it didn't quite hold up to our classic. I watched this again, and it's even better.
Brilliant, right.
You know, in a quality sense, it's fabulous. There's so many great lines, and I think looking at the cliffhangers, it interests me actually. The cliffhangers, both episode one and two, and to some extent three, are quite unusual.
They're horrific, aren't they?
It's
they're body horror.
As we've said, body horror. And this is a sort of thing you read about with the Hinchcliffe era. It's body horror, but it's basically you're not being the characters' lives aren't at threat. Now the Doctor, you know, his life is threatened several times during this story, as is Sarah Jane. That would be the classic. Let's have them in peril. Oh God, he's going to die.
Doctor Who's going to die.
At the end of the cliffhanger, but no, in the cliffhanger episode one, it's Sarah being confronted by the headless body of the sort of the Frankenstein's monster type thing, which isn't actually terribly threatening. It just looks fucking awful. It's horrible for tea time telly. And then the second episode, it's the brain in the jar, which again, it poses no threat to Sarah Jane. Obviously, she's blind, but you know, what can a brain do?
It's a visceral reveal.
It's a visceral reveal. It's wonderful. And it's a great idea. Just like and that's what sticks in your head as a kid. Well, they're obsessing about that brain. Did you see that brain in the jar?
Well,
marvelous. Oh yeah.
When Kondo is shot. I mean, I apologise if any of the listeners haven't seen it. I might be giving away a spoiler. But when Kondo is shot, it's quite graphic.
You see blood.
It's an explosion on his... You know, a couple of years later, you wouldn't have got that.
It's a double death as well for him, because he gets a gunshot, and then he's basically strangled to death by the monster afterwards, with the gut wound.
But that's kind of to explain what a strong kind of character he is,
But it's strong as well on screen. It's nasty. They really labour that exit for that character, which is an interesting point because it's mostly rewritten by Bob Holmes. Terence Dix wrote the script, wasn't happy that the original character Solon was supposed to be a robot collecting body parts.
Was he? That wouldn't have worked.
And said that was the whole point. He uses body parts that don't work because he's a robot working logically. Changed it for a human, Solon, and Terry Dix was on holiday, came back from holiday, found it had been rewritten, and was so unhappy, he said, "Oh, I don't like this. Put some bland pseudonym on it."
Yes,
and it's Robin
Bland.
Yes.
But I think it works better as being a professor.
I think it does. Here's the main problem with the whole sort of thing, the whole serial, is that... So Tom Baker walks in as Doctor Who, and he thinks, "Oh, what a marvellous head." I can attach that to my weird mutant brain. Where the fuck? Doesn't he just remove Tom Baker's brain and whack in Morbius?
There's no logic at all.
It's ridiculous.
Don't think about it for too long.
No, but that is just the... Oh, but we must have a strange claw-like creature, so, you know, we can't not have that. It's Barbie.
I mean, it's Shakespeare, in a way, and I'll expand on that, because I think it needs expanding on rather than just saying it's Shakespeare.
Yeah, we were all just going to go, yeah, fine, whatever.
But Shakespeare he recognised a good story.
Yes,
he worked with Bob Holmes. Bob Holmes was his script editor. For the first Folio.
Season 40.
Yes, up until Hamlet, and then he got rid of Bob Holmes and brought in...
Eric Sarwat.
Later, Anthony Reeve.
Dead now.
Died this year. Yeah. But it's Shakespeare in the respect that Shakespeare culled stories. Yes. He knew, he recognised a good story, so he thinks, that's a good story, I'll have a bit of that. That's also a good story. I've heard of that. And I'll mix it all together. Brain of Morbius, it's kind of... It's Hammer horror.
Yeah.
It's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. There are elements of all kinds of successful stories woven together. And there's nothing wrong with that.
There's a lot of Shakespeare with the witches. And,
yeah, it's like Macbeth, isn't it? Yeah.
Very much so.
So I think that you're right there. And the plot is immaterial almost. It's the sort of the feel of it. But it happens to be actually quite well written as well in terms of, you know, if you've got pretty much three sets, you've got Solon in his castle, and that included laboratory. You've got the Sisterhood of Khan's gaff. And then you've got some rocky outcrops. You know, that's pretty much all they got to work with. But, and they just dally around between all those three. But it works really well. And I think another reason why it works is because of the acting. It's just so...
The acting is... Philip Madoc.
I was itching to get on to Philip Madoc. Philip Madoc and Tom Baker.
Together on screen.
One of the things that occurs to me as I was just settling down with a glass of whiskey to watch it last night was that... I may have mentioned this before, but when Doctor Who hasn't arrived yet, they're the bits that I hated when I was reading the Target novelisation. Where's Doctor Who with his curly mop of hair and his open face? His wheezing, groaning
sound. Old, young face.
Where's Doctor Who? But you don't really mind that he hasn't arrived yet. You don't get a huge amount of time without the Doctor being there. But Madoc and Greville, is it Greville?
Greville.
Those two are so good, aren't they? You know, they could hold a show on their own.
God, yeah.
And then you've got Tom Baker in the mix, and it just suddenly comes to a kick in life.
He's got a yo-yo. Well, I have to say, you know, we were talking earlier in this episode, in fact, about Philip Hinchcliffe and about the Philip Hinchcliffe era. Of course, after he left Doctor Who, he went on to make Target, which was a more adult action-adventure series, which had Patrick Moher, who was quite well known for having been in Callan, at that time, but also Philip Madoc, with whom obviously he worked in Brain of Morbius. Terrific series. I've never seen it. I'd love to
see it. But Madoc is so good, isn't he? And I wondered about Madoc, actually, this is as an aside. Why isn't he considered as one of the great actors of our time?
Now as I was young and easy under the apple boughs, about the lilting house and happy as the grass was green, the night above the dingle starry, time let me hail and climb golden in the heydays of his eyes. And honoured among wagons, I was prince of the apple towns. And once below a time, I lordly had the trees and leaves trail with daisies and barley down the rivers of the windfall light. And as I was green and carefree, famous among the barns, about the happy yard, and singing as the farm was home, in the sun that is young once only, time let me play and be golden in the mercy of his means. And green and golden, I was huntsman and herdsman. The calves sang to my horn, the foxes on the hills barked clear and cold, and the Sabbath rang slowly in the pebbles of the holy streams.
Because he just reduced himself and went to sort of appear in bit things. It reminded me of Ian McKellen, Anthony Hopkins. This is the knights of the acting profession who did amazing stage work.
He did an awful lot.
Bit of telly. But he's super.
He's a phenomenal. Derek Jacobi.
Very, very good.
I think it is sort of, you know, hyperbole and it's all nonsense and people are going to say, oh, what's he all about? But I think he's pretty good. And if you can make Doctor Who seem operatic and Shakespearean.
Yes, very Shakespearean.
He was given some incredible lines. And I've got a piece here which I lifted from watching it last week. And this is typical Bob Holmes with a very strong actor.
Yes.
And this actually foreshadows the kind of style of writing that we love in Revelation of the Daleks and Caves of Androzani. Yes. Nasty, nasty dialogue.
Oh, yeah, which is Gay Warden.
Wonderful stuff.
Go on, please.
And this is Solon talking about the Sisterhood of Khan. I won't do the Welsh accent. That squalid brood of harpies, yes, the Sisterhood, that accursed hag Maren found I was holding a Time Lord and rescued him. May her stinking bones rot. I'll see her die, Kondo. I'll see that palsied Harrodin scream for death before Morbius and I are finished with her.
It's wonderful.
It's pure Shakespeare.
It's superb, though. Yeah, and I had hairs on the back of my neck because Madoc performing
his delivery of it.
It's just superb.
Yes.
It's absolutely wonderful.
This is a pure aside. Noticed on Facebook more recently a pie chart that was posted about deaths in Shakespeare. Someone had cobbled together a pie chart of all the different deaths in Shakespeare. Every single way that a character is killed. You know, 50% are stabbings.
Right.
It's just a pure aside.
Yeah.
But Philip Maddock, though.
Wonderful.
You know, Tom Baker was extremely impressed with Philip Maddock on set. Brain of Morbius, he recalls, I can't remember when, but he says Philip Maddock was reading a book in Latin. that impressed me greatly.
I suspect they were drinking partners.
Yes.
There's a sense in which they're equals, aren't they? And you know, I think that was a very sort of whoever had the idea to make them equals and to make them interact as equals, as characters. Was very wise, because obviously he's the baddie, and there's some stage where you think, why the hell would you leave Sarah Jane with the baddie, in inverted commas? Because they're because Tom Baker, Doctor, sees him as an equal. It's like, well, actually, we're both scientists, and okay, you know, there are some silly things, but what I liked about the character of the Doctor, it says a lot about when Sarah Jane goes blind. Spoiler, she goes blind, and so he asks Solon to examine her eyes, because he respects the guy as a scientist.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a wonderful moment where Solon just goes, no, tilts his head to the Doctor, and there's a wonderful connection between the two of them there.
Yeah. But
a meeting of minds.
But I think that you compare that to, dare I say it, the new series, where the Doctor is basically sort of a godlike figure who can do anything and knows everything. It's like, well, actually, the Doctor is a very intelligent man, but he would defer to a scientist who's a scientist who knows more about it than he does.
Yes.
And even though he's one of his arch enemies because he's trying to bring this awful man back to life, then we'll still respect him. And that's good. I think that respect.
It bristles with drama.
Yeah.
I had a very interesting experience watching this. On DVD, because it was the first time I've seen the uncut Brain of Morbius. Because the version I had was
circumcised.
Was the
Jewish version.
The Brain of Morbius VHS from the 80s, which was 60 minutes long.
And about 60 quid to buy.
Yes. I didn't have that.
And it was heavily edited.
Yeah. I had the 1990.
And if you notice, Tom, there is no certification on there of the age. It's that old. So I saw it for the first time, and it reminded me because of the novel which I read, which I thought was much more graphic. But actually, I was surprised to see that the episodes contain most of the graphic content, which is when they put the head of the mutant, on the little device, and the eyes start twitching. That was in the book.
I don't know. Why did they edit it down to 60 minutes? I think it was the content.
Without the credits and stuff, they just...
They cut out a lot of the content and the credits, but it should run to about 90 minutes, even without the credits in. And there was a hideous moment when Solon unplugs the tank and all of the goo comes out. I had never seen that before.
Oh, really?
So it really was wonderful to see for the first time.
There's a hilarious bit where the brain falls on the floor. fucking brain on the floor.
It's horrible, but it's funny.
Philip Maddock is wonderful.
And there's so much humour in this. There's a wonderful bit where Tom Baker is transported to the Sisterhood of Khan's lair. And he says, hello, matron, Maren.
And he calls her matron a few times. Yeah.
And there's a follow-up little gag, and he says, I had a little drink about an hour ago. But, of course, Jaws was released in 1975, shortly before the Brain of Morbius. I think that might be a little reference to Jaws.
In what way?
Out of the engine.
I'm here.
Results. Right. Yeah. But I, going back to our conversation about Hinchcliffe, this is what made me think about it. Is that you know, Tom Baker is not going for the laughs.
No,
he's not like, it's not mugging. Mm-hmm. You're not doing that sort of later Graham Willis. The whole show isn't trying to say let's make you laugh, but it is funny. You know, his
character
attitude
humor, yeah.
to stuff, and yeah. It's just brilliant.
It's dark. It's like theatre. You know, with so few sets.
Yes,
and not much moving about. It has an intensity. So it's not. You don't feel that they're sort of dragging it out. It's dark. It's very intense drama.
Mm. I go back to the sort of episode 3 thing. In a lot of the Doctor Who, episode 3 is the runaround, is the sort of the point is get rid of it. It wasn't like that in this. It was really good. Mm. there was bits that was silly in episode 4, but you know that's.
Well, you mentioned about the silliness of having the monster where you could just put Morbius's brain in Doctor Who. Yeah. I mean the bit I don't like about Brain and Morbius, and it's just a personal prejudice of mine, but I don't really like sort of sisterhoods and people chant.
I get like that. Bored. You know, I just
load of jabbering women in the room.
Jabbering women. Yeah. Reminds you of school.
Exactly. You know, these weird cults that you get. I don't know. I just find it a little.
Isn't that why you quit
tedious.
Your job? It's just like that all day.
Yes.
Bloody women are going for the tea run.
Yeah.
no, I agree. But there's a couple of things that I'm not that keen on. Like the plan to feed cyanide up the ventilation shaft.
Yes.
But it just so happens that at that moment Solos brought the creature back to life. Well, if he hadn't, they'd been a bit screwed, wouldn't they?
It would have exactly. There's no sense there. And there's also that there's a very Russell T Davies ending where the TARDIS dematerialises with an explosion of a firecracker.
Quite
which I overlooked when I was younger, but now I think if that was in the new series, I'd be spitting feathers. Fury.
It was the sort of firework joke, wasn't it? Blue touch paper.
Yeah,
but,
that's right.
Not to my taste, but seeing it back again now, I don't quite like that. Mm. But I think it's a cracking story, and I think it's
cracking.
Typical.
It's better than Frankenstein. It's a bit dreary.
Mary Shelley, eat your heart.
Have you read Frankenstein recently?
I read it.
Not recently.
I studied
it about 15 years.
University.
It's dreary, isn't it?
Mm. Well, I offend. I ended my feminist lecturer by saying I don't think it's very good, and I don't even think it's even written by Mary Shelley. I think it's written by her husband. Because there's evidence in the manuscript
possibly,
to
I
say
that. I wasn't like
there's a lot of evidence to say.
I saw a production of it in London that Danny Boyle did. It was a bit silly. You saw Benedict Cumberbatch's
his
bum all the way up his bumhole. Yes, it was quite remarkable. Yeah. This is before he was in Sherlock, I think. But it was his bumhole live on stage.
Yes.
What did it say?
Oscillating.
Hello.
I'm trapped in here.
from the bumhole of Cumberbatch to the brain of Morbius. How many TARDISes out of 5?
Jeremy Brett was better.
4.5.
Four and a half,
if
Tom?
Not five, but I'm just...
If not five?
Five, maybe.
Room for improvement.
4.5.
Room for improvement. See me after class.
4, I'm fussy. 4.
It's 4 for me.
Well,
but I love it. I love it.
I do love it. I do love it.
And the book's well worth checking out. I loved the novel as a kid.
Thumbs up.
Although Philip Maddock's performance, 5.
Yeah?
Yes. Oh.
That's the best bit about it. You can't take Tom Baker and Liz Sladen for granted. And maybe I am doing, because they're also wonderful... in it.
Her tracksuit bottoms are something to behold.
But Philip Maddock, one of the great guest performances. Yes,
absolutely. And I realised watching it, I felt quite privileged because I met most of the cast from The Brain of Morbius.
Really? Really?
I've met Philip Maddock, Gilly.
Yeah, Gilly Brown.
Gilly Brown. Stuart Fell, who plays the body of Morbius.
Yes, he does. Yes.
And Tom Baker.
Yes.
Elizabeth Sladen.
Yes.
And Philip Hinchcliffe. Mm-hmm.
Have you met Kondo?
No.
He's still alive.
Is he still going?
I don't know.
Let's meet him.
Let's do it. Okay. Kondo it is.
So that's us reviewing.
Let's meet
and
Kondo
finishing
and
off
Kondo.
With The Brain of Morbius. Now we're going to go into the Celestial Toy Room to talk about the 2 annuals from the Hinchcliffe era.
Well, that'll be good.
Now in the world of the Celestial Toy Maker. He manipulates people and makes them into his playthings.
We have here the Doctor Who Annual 1976, published in 75, and the substantially larger format, for some reason, Doctor Who Annual 1977. It's the only one.
So it looks awkward. Bugger for the bookshelf, isn't it?
Yeah, it's black sheep. It has a black spine as well.
Yeah.
76.
Tom's
first annual. Do you have
that? I don't have it currently, but it was one of them. I didn't have it as a sort of a child, but I had it as a teenager as one of those, a Doctor Who annual, I must buy it for a pound in a second-hand bookshop. It's probably worth about £1,000 nowadays. Well, we go for a pretty penny, aren't they?
Yes.
But it's a lovely little object. It's wonderful. Yes, Moonstruck, a galaxy of stars. Boom.
Yes. I mean, people have the Doctor Who annuals in their collection. I'm one of them. But
very rarely read them.
Yes, exactly. There's not a lot of information in there.
There's not. There's occasionally articles about space, yes, which is a bit bizarre.
There's mostly incredibly poor pictures of Tom Baker.
And it's the same reference photo. So if you look at that picture from page 20
of the 76.
And page 57.
If anyone's got those.
I'm sure you've got them out now. It's the same reference photography they use. And it seems to be generic women playing the companions in these days.
Generic women.
Everywhere.
All worst kind. Women are generic.
I mean, look at that on page 17 of 76. It looks like Steptoe.
What's going on with his arrogance?
I don't know, but it looks like a bit between Steptoe and Fagin.
Dirty old man.
And then look at this one. I mean, it is a rather strange picture.
It's starting to get very experimental at this point. Yeah. The artwork.
The illustrations are beautiful, but they're kind of a bit mad.
So 76 is very much a carry on of the Pertwee stuff, really. There's puzzles. There's the odd comic strip, some very vaguely written stories, and two-tone photographs. And
one of them has Colin Baker making an unexpected...
It's 1977.
Is it 77?
Really?
Show Tom, yes.
It's quite remarkable. It's in a comic strip.
Oh, we found
so
Colin
you were saying
Baker.
That you were,
we have found
Colin Baker appears in the comic strip here on page 42 in costume.
Yes, multicoloured coat and a blue sort of what do they call this thing? A tie hanky
scarf.
Scarf.
A cravat.
A cravat, that's it.
And he's arguably in the best Colin Baker story in the 1970s.
Samuel sent me that picture and I said, oh, is that from the Colin Baker annual? He said, no, it's from the annual 1976. I said,
Nightmare. Oh. It's terrible.
It's on its fair, the 1976 one, but the 1977 one is possibly my favourite annual from the 70s.
Really?
Because it's fucking bonkers.
It is, yes. It's disturbingly bonkers.
The artist has confessed since that he was on all sorts of mind-bending drugs, apparently.
Really?
You only have to open the first page to see a disembodied hand for no reason.
Hand of fear.
Flying across.
Hand of fear, maybe.
The hand of fear. Do you think? Yes.
And Tom squatting.
Tom doing a poo.
And as you work through, gradually, you find more and more bizarre
bits. That's almost like a kind of a Dutch master painting, isn't it? With lots of the shadows on the first page.
You're obsessed with the Dutch masters today. You've got veneer on the brain.
There is a comic strip in here, which is horrific, which shows a skull-like Tom Baker.
Yes, you had it up before.
I did. Miss Babs. A skull-like Tom Baker in a comic strip, which
skeletal.
Is... Skeletal. In a comic strip called Scraffing. The Body Snatcher. And there it's on page 36.
Oh,
and
crumbs,
it's the stuff
terrible.
Of horror.
It's like one of those mummies you see in museums.
Yes, that used to be Tom Baker.
And then there are perfectly good paintings in here, which the artist has decided just to scribble on with a crayon.
Was that not
and I thought,
child that did that?
I thought, is this a second-hand defaced annual? But no, it's actually the artwork on page 46. Tom Baker looking shocked. Covered in white crayon. Look at that.
I always assumed someone had just defaced it.
And that's a story called The Eye Spiders of Pergross.
Pergross, yeah, it's a strange word.
Sounds like a shoe shop.
They weren't the best adverts for Doctor Who, and they certainly aren't
really
the best adverts for that Hinchcliffe era.
Is that William Hartnell? Is that William Hartnell that I've just seen? That's William Hartnell.
No, it's not.
Is that Perry?
In the Terror Trail, which is a board game that you can play.
Is that meant to be Harry Sullivan, then? I mean,
God knows
who
these people are. Just people who just appeared.
I think it might be Ben, with long 70s hair. They are curiosities, as you say, Tom, and they couldn't be further away from Doctor Who. These could be episodes of... The Persuaders, or anything really.
The Sweeney.
It's so vague. The Sweeney.
Oh, I like this though. Page 76, puzzles more than meets the eye. Which line is longer? I used to be obsessed with optical illusions when I was a kid.
I still like them.
So which line is longer?
Well, they're the same length.
Yeah, and look at this cube. And is it a vase or a face? Or a couple of faces? I love those things.
It's all very... And they're easy
to pick up. Parallel lines? Yes, they are.
They don't seem to be.
Doctor Who
is so relevant.
There's a fascinating feature here on the Goodyear blimp.
Airship rises to fame.
Some of the artwork is wonderful. There's a lovely picture of Tom Baker on page 16.
So it, I would give him a miss, really. There's more curiosity.
Peter Cushing or Brezhnev? Adolf Hitler, for sure. Or is it Rudyard Kipling?
Herman Oberth.
Oh. Well,
I'd give these again one TARDIS out of five.
they're a curiosity, but rather a pointless one.
I think they improved in terms of content during the John Nathan Turner era.
John Nathan Turner.
Yeah. When there was more features about the making of the show and some behind-the-scenes pictures. There's nothing of that in here. It's barely Doctor Who, really. The only photograph he gets on the front page. And you don't even get that in 1937 stuff.
Illustrations are vaguely good if you're interested in that.
Well, let's not end on a damp squib. We have to sort of end on some sort of positivity.
Great stuff on the telly. The books were good.
Yeah.
But the annuals... Yeah, miss. But otherwise, the finest era of Doctor Who we're agreed on.
I think so. That was the positive note I want to end on. I'm really keen on this era.
It was jolly good.
Yeah.
But we're moving into more dangerous territory.
IF stands for Index File.
I've got a character here. Mm. Seeds of Doom.
Yes.
Sir Colin Thackeray, Michael Barrington, dead or alive.
I think he's dead.
I think he must be dead, because he sounds like an older character.
Really?
Yeah.
Sir Colin Thackeray, played by Michael Barrington. Dead or alive? Greg?
Dead.
And it's the year he died.
Yeah.
So I reckon he died in 1985.
82,
I think. It's 88, so Sam is closer. But I have to say, Seeds of Doom, Kenneth Gilbert... who played... What was his character's name? Dunbar. Get Dunbar.
Yeah.
Get Dunbar! Alive or dead?
Dead, recently.
Alive.
Very recently died. He died only a couple of months ago. He died in October 2015, Kenneth Gilbert.
I've got a question, and it's about Seeds of Doom. John Challis, TV's Boyce...
Yes.
...is appearing in Panto this year. But what town/city is he appearing in Panto in?
Rochdale.
What's your guess, sir?
Stepney.
Stepney? No, it's Bradford.
Oh!
Bradford, they were Bradford and Lambra. The Billy Pierce.
Oh, he's done okay, actually.
We saw a picture of him.
Still employable.
Me and my daughter saw a picture of him, and he said, she pointed out and said, "What's that?" And I said, It's Boise from Lonely Falls and Horses.
Yes.
Why does he look so upset? Well, he's the baddie, isn't he?
Put your finger down.
Oh, he's not the dame.
No, he's a baddie. He's Abenazer or something. There we are. Ooh.
Lee Hassan
Shah. John Bennett.
John Bennett.
Dead.
We all know he's dead.
I reckon he died in 2003.
I was going to say 2004.
2003. John Bennett.
John Bennett.
Lai Seng Channel.
He's very good in Huang Chiang, isn't he?
Yes. Fine Chinese actor.
He's also in...
In 2005 he died. So age 76.
Was that you?
I was slightly close.
So point for you. We had it equalised now. It's a tiebreaker.
Okay. So you select from the era.
From the era. Okay, we're talking Tenor of the Zygon.
Yes.
And we're talking, John Woodnut.
Dead.
Yeah, we know he's dead.
2006, I would say.
I think you're right. I think I'll just say 2005 to be obtuse.
Okay, let's look.
He's definitely dead.
He's dead, Miss Babs.
Look him up.
In fact, I think it's 2003.
The episode is hinging on this hinge bracket.
I think it was slightly later than 2003.
Well, you say 2005, don't you?
Six.
You say 2003. Let's see what the actual official date is.
2006.
But
only by a squeak. 2nd of January 2006.
Well done.
Age 81.
Even so, Greg, you are this week's winner. So
I know my deaths.
Well done.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Yes, it's lovely, lovely.
Well, it's
lovely having you in the cab. Coming up in the next episode, we're getting all political, talking about politics and Doctor Who. Is Doctor Who a lefty?
Jeremy Corbyn's the next Doctor Who.
Let's hope so.
He's got my vote. All that and more in the next exciting episode of...
Doctor Who, the Complete Menagerie.
Almost! If you enjoyed listening to that twaddle, you can follow us on Twitter at DW Menagerie. That's at DW Menagerie, and we'll be tweeting various photographs of our inside leg measurements and that sort of thing.
Doctor Who is copyright of the BBC.
No infringements on copyright are intended. Support Doctor Who by purchasing DVDs and CDs and all other media from the BBC. Any comments made by the complete menagerie, almost, are all our own.
You've been listening to a Sixth Floor production.